is Jackie Lamport. Today is Monday, October 18th. Welcome to the Capital Daily Podcast. Today on the show.
What I hope we've achieved is a city that's ready for the future. We won't know that until 20 years from now, when hopefully we've met our emissions targets, when hopefully we have a circular economy, we're not throwing things in the garbage, when hopefully almost all of the cars in the city are electric powered.
Victoria Mayor Lisa Helps has been working at her post for 7 years. But as we mark 1 year left in her term, she has decided she will not be running for re-election. Today, we speak with her about the highs and lows of the past 7 years and what to expect in the final days. Today's Capital Daily Podcast is brought to you by Island Deaf and Hard of Hearing Center, providing hearing aids for good, along with trusted services to Island residents for 30 years. For information, go to idhhc.ca. Lisa, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
So first off, why? Why are you planning on not running again?
Well, even before I ran in 2018, right before the last municipal election, I made a commitment to myself and to the public that I would run for one more term. I feel for a number of reasons, 8 years at the pace and velocity at which we've been working is a lot. And I am a person that can only go kind of 150%. And the thought of doing that for four more years, for 12 years in total, feels like a bit too much. But also, I think it's really healthy in any organization to have turnover. And 8 years as mayor and CEO of the city of Victoria, that's a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, look at America. You can't be president more than two terms in a row. There's reasons
exactly.
For that.
And I think there's something really healthy about that. I mean, you know, ultimately the voters would say, and if I did run again and got tossed out, then I know that the time was up. But I think that 8 years is a good amount of time for anyone to be in a leadership position like this. And then there's room for new ideas and fresh blood and just kind of see what happens.
Do you have anybody in mind that you'd like to see run?
Well, I know that there are a couple of my councillors who are considering it. Councillor Alto, I think, is considering a run, as is Councillor Andrew. I think it'll be an interesting election if they both decide to run, because that means there are, by default and de facto, two vacancies on council automatically. Mm-hmm. You know, if I had to pick today, I would put my weight behind Councillor Alto, only because she's been at the council table for 10 years, has a depth of experience, and really knows a lot about how the city works, how City Hall works. She's got strong connections in the community. And so if the election were today, that's what I would say. But we don't even know who's actually going to put their name forward and how that's going to shake down come next year.
What advice would you give for anybody who wants to run? What would you say about your experience?
What I would say is be prepared to dedicate your heart, soul, mind, body, your whole life to this job. It's not for the faint heart, that's for sure. I mean, you can do it in a bit of a half-assed way, but that's not going to take the city in the direction it needs to go. We've done a lot this past term getting ready for the future, but there's still a lot more work to do. So I would say it's got to be somebody who's got that ability to carry out some big projects and some big ideas. And also, you know, one of the things that I've learned that's absolutely invaluable, the ability to collaborate and to work across difference, to work with people you might not have ever thought you'd find yourself sitting across a table from. And in this position, you need to be willing to sit down and work with just about everyone who comes along.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. In the past 7 years of you as mayor, what are some of the things that you are most proud of accomplishing?
I think a couple of things. I'll just pick up on that, the collaboration. This is just an example. When I started as mayor, I got all these meeting requests from the Chamber of Commerce, the Downtown Victoria Business Association, the Greater Victoria Harbour Authority, the Urban Development Institute. And then, so I started these one-on-one meetings. And then I realized they were also all having one-on-one meetings with each other. And I was like, oh my God, that's a lot of meetings. And so I eventually just invited everyone to lunch. And we stopped all our one-on-one meetings and have been meeting all together. And it's been extremely effective. It allows us to stay connected with what's happening in each other's organizations, to effectively lobby the provincial and federal governments. And I think those kinds of things, I think, so one of the things, I guess, in short, that I feel proud of is that we've kind of changed the way that the city does business. We're I think, seen as a valued partner in many ways to many organizations with real human-to-human relationships. The pandemic is another example. We are in lockstep with BC Housing and Island Health. Sometimes I feel that, you know, is it an internal meeting or an external meeting? It doesn't matter because we've been working really, really hard and really closely together. So I feel like that is a big success, and it's kind of one of those intangible pieces, but it sure as heck makes it easier to get things done when you can just send someone a text message on Friday night or Saturday morning and say, hey, there's an emergency, can we meet right now? And they say, absolutely, yes. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I feel, and again, this is not something that I or council can take credit for, but one of the things that I've noticed in the last 7 years, and probably particularly in the last three or four, is a real increase in diversity in our city. You can stand on the street corner at some time downtown and hear two or three different languages coming into your ears. There's more people who are, you know, racialized minorities, visible minorities. And I think that is just so important for the future of our city. Obviously, there's a lot of work to do still addressing racism, making Victoria more welcoming, working on inclusion. But that's a visible change in the city over the last 7 years. And you know, again, I don't know what, if anything, council has to do about with that or myself, but I think that's another positive change. And then I guess the last one is really just all of the things we've done to set the table for the future, whether it's Zero Waste Victoria or our climate leadership plan or Victoria 3.0, which is our 20-year economic plan, or Go Victoria. There are all of these things that are in place that are now operationalized at the staff level. But that's been a lot of heavy lifting over the last 7 years to get those across the table.
Mm, awesome. Yeah, you've definitely been a mayor of looking forward to creating a better future for Victoria, which means that we might not even really see some of the impacts until later on, much, much after your term.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really good way of putting it.
When you were fresh in office, your first couple days, your first couple months maybe, what were your original priorities going in? What did you want your time to be consumed with?
Well, one of the reasons I ran for mayor in the first place was because I felt, even as a councillor, that City Hall was a place that said no first. If you came with an idea or, you know, something you wanted to work together on the city, it was like no or maybe, not like yes, awesome, how can we do that together? And that is really what I wanted to achieve. Again, it's a bit of an intangible, but that when people have an idea or something they want to work on, City Hall is there for them. And I think, you know, I would evaluate our success. I mean, there's always more to do, and there's probably some people who would say City Hall doesn't like my ideas at all. But I, you know, things like the increase in our strategic plan grants, our Migrate Neighborhood grants. We've got like just about an advisory committee right now for everything we're working on. There's a renters advisory committee, a seniors advisory committee, accessibility advisory committee, active transportation advisory committee. So we've really kind of, I think, drawn people in and broken down a little bit the barrier between what is a city hall and what is a community. So that was definitely one of my main objectives when I started. And in fact, the reason that I ran, I think, you know, our first economic action plan when I was first elected was called Making Victoria Unleashing Potential. And I felt like Victoria was a place that potential was stunted and thwarted. And part of what I wanted to do was help unleash that potential.
And then you had your first major issue. What would you qualify as your first major issue before I ask?
No, my first major issue was the day I was sworn in, which was not swearing an oath of allegiance to the Queen.
I was going to ask about that. I had another specific thing, but I did want to ask about that one as well. So maybe we can jump ahead to that. You had a lot of instances where you were you know, making stances that were quite controversial. There was the not swearing the oath of allegiance to the Queen. There was the removal of the John A. Macdonald statue. And then even more recently, there was the canceling of the Canada Day celebrations. It's a lot of very progressive, controversial, or conversation starting, at least I could say, symbolic moments. What do you think that that did to your run? How did that impact how you dealt with the community?
Well, let's just focus on the statue, because I would say that was probably the most difficult of those three. I mean, although they are all related and they are, I think, symbolic moments for sure. But the statue was really about relationship. And we had been talking and working in a very intimate way through the city family, which is the city's reconciliation body, with the Songhees and Esquimalt Nations for a year at that point. And every time they came into City Hall to have dinner in my office, they would need to walk past that statue every month. And that was painful. And at a certain point, they said to us, if you are really serious about this work we're doing together, about decolonizing, about reconciliation, then just, you know, please move that statue. So when we come here to speak with you, we don't have to have a reminder of the fact that this man helped to set up a school system, which traumatized and alienated our children and our families, which, you know, we all are starting to learn the legacy of the residential school system. So that request came, you know, it was a year in the making, and we decided to move the statue in August of 2018, which was 2.5 months before the last municipal election. And what I couldn't have done was said to the Songhees and Esquimalt, oh, well, just wait and let's see if I get reelected and we'll move the statue then. Because that is not how you do reconciliation. That is how you do politics. And that's one of the reasons I don't like politics. And so it was, you know, it was controversial to move the statue. It started a national conversation about who was John A. Macdonald, what were these residential schools. You know, one of the things that I thought was so interesting is, like, people that you're erasing history, but you'd never ever seen John A. Macdonald's name in the news as much as you did in those weeks following the removal of the statue. And so it was necessary. And just like, you know, decisions that seem controversial at the time, you know, I don't know now after what happened in Kamloops and other places this summer, if there's even one statue of John A. Macdonald standing anywhere in the country. The only difference is we did it 3 years earlier and for a different reason, mm-hmm. or related, but different reason. It was about relationship.
Yeah. But you didn't need the national event to prompt it.
No, yeah. We needed our deep relationships with the people of this land.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I mean, doing all of those things, it's very bold. It can be very difficult in politics. How did that impact you?
The Queen one was hard because it was literally my first day in office. I was like, okay, I'm getting hate mail from Toronto. literally just sworn in. So I think that one I was surprised at the reaction, because nobody else in this whole region swears an oath of allegiance to the Queen when they're sworn in. They just swear their oath of office. So that one was difficult because I wasn't prepared for it. I was literally in office for a day and sparking a national controversy. I think it was difficult. But also it gave me an opportunity that I hadn't anticipated, which is I got, you know, invited onto various radio shows across the country, you know, with questions beginning like, how could you do this? Victoria's a little bit of old England, you know, and it actually gave me an opportunity to pivot and tell what I thought Victoria's new and emerging story was. And so, you know, I found that quite satisfying, to use the opportunity to tell the story of what Victoria is becoming, not what it has been.
Awesome. Okay. And we'll take a quick break for a word from our sponsor. Today's Capital Daily Podcast is brought to you by Max Sold, your local experts for downsizing and estate sales. At Max Sold, they assist thousands of Canadians each year with a process that's quick, practical, and transparent. Their local experts provide on-site and online service, and they can get everything sold and removed in less than 2 weeks. Visit them at maxsold.com or call 1-866-586-1799. Get $50 off with code CAPITALDAILY50. Terms and conditions apply. MaxSold.com. The issue that I was referring to, the first or one of the first major issues that you came into was the Johnson Street Bridge, which dominated a lot of your first term. It did end up going over budget, about $40 million, and it was also a couple years late. In hindsight, do you think that there's anything that could have been done better to avoid that? Or is there any disappointments there?
Absolutely. And that is what my, you know, that's another reason that I ran is what, you know, I was on council when we approved the Johnson Street Bridge, and I voted against it, the approval of the contract, because it was a bad contract. It was a bridge that was at best 30% designed when we signed the contract. And that's fine. You know, there's a lot of room for innovation in that kind of approach when you're working with the builder to design the bridge, but when we signed the contract, the budget only had a 4% contingency. And so even like, and I, you know, I was a relatively lay person. I'd never, you know, signed a big, you know, giant construction contract for $92 million as a counselor. But you just look at that and you see something is going to go off the rails here. Because if you've only got a bridge that's 30% designed and a 4% contingency budget, there's very little wiggle room. And so when I became mayor, I inherited that project, and we put in place all of the things that should have been in place when that project began, so that all of our other infrastructure projects, and, you know, I'll give you a quiz in a moment to see if you know, have gone really well. So that we put in an estimates policy, we put in a quality project management framework. There's a project lead for every project. Everything that wasn't in place on the Johnson Street Bridge is in place now. So much so that I think the general public doesn't even realize that we're working on a major capital project right now, because it's never in the news. So that's my question. You know, even as somebody who's in your role, what is the city's major capital project that we have underway right now?
Oh, you know, I feel I've been out of the loop. I've been on vacation for the best 2 weeks.
That is true. So. That's true. So it's our fire hall on Johnson Street. So that's a $40 million project.
Yes,
a new
yes.
fire hall, affordable housing, and you just don't hear a peep about it. Not a peep. And, and I think that to me shows that we've really pivoted away from the way we used to do projects, i.e. the Johnson Street Bridge, to how we do them now.
I will say my editor, Jimmy Thompson, was just telling me about that one yesterday. He's pretty on top of things. So I'll give him credit for that one. But yes, he had told me about it. That's the first I had heard of it, though.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's, you know, that's a testimony to A, the hardworking city staff who put in place all of these new policies and procedures at council's direction. But with the fire hall, just in contrast to the bridge, we had two quantity surveyors go over every single inch of the design and the plans, work with the fire department. So we knew that when we were signing a contract for that, it was going to be the price that we were needing to deliver what was laid out in the plans. And we're having the private sector build it. And they give us the keys and we pay them the money when it's done.
Okay. You know, this kind of segues into my next set of questions that I had. I wanted to look at a few things from your 2018 platform. And one of the things I wanted to mention was the Crystal Pool and Wellness Center. Is there any possibility that there's anything moving behind the scenes that we haven't really heard about because of all of these new plans in place?
I would say no. The city made a very deliberate decision to essentially, and by the city, I mean council, to park Crystal Pool and Wellness Center to the next term. So that'll pick up again in 2023. One of the things that we are doing instead that we committed to last term but didn't do is getting plans underway for a new central library. That's been a longstanding priority as well. And so in a sense, I think we had to choose one big project to get underway in addition to the fire hall. And so staff are working right now on a feasibility study for either a new or renovated central library. And that's been 40 years in the making. The library has actually been in its temporary space for about four decades.
Wow. Okay. All right. Well, I'll move on to the next couple things I had. One of the points.
Before we leave Crystal Pool, you know, I think the original imperative for Crystal Pool was lack of accessibility. You know, it is an old facility, but we recently adopted a corporate energy and emissions management plan. And Crystal Pool, we've known this all along, but seeing it in the context of other city assets, Crystal Pool is the single largest emitter of greenhouse gas emissions of any of the city's buildings. Mm. And so if we are going to meet our climate targets by 2030, we will need a new pool by that time, full stop. Otherwise, we're not going to meet our climate goals. And so I think that puts a bit of a different light on the importance of the Crystal Pool project, for me anyway.
Would the potential plan be to retrofit the whole building?
No, we did a very detailed analysis of renovate, expand, and retrofit, and a new build. And the value for money and the kind of the long-term investment, a full-on new build was the best economic outcome. So, unless the numbers change, but that's very unlikely, given that time is passing and things only get more expensive. So, yeah, I think that analysis was done. What it came down to was the site, and there were some people in the neighborhood who didn't like the planned site. And so, it'll be back to the drawing board on that. But, another thing we have very firmly in place now that we didn't as well when we started the original Crystal Pool project was a very built out strategic real estate department that has the ability to look at all sorts of land in all sorts of creative ways. So I think we'll see what the next council does with that one, but something needs to happen.
Okay. One of the other things that you had in your 2018 platform was there was a point about increasing well-paying jobs and taking care of vulnerable residents. You had mentioned that 50% of Victorians at that time made $27,000 per year or less, which I was baffled at when I read. And you said young people had a hard time finding and living in any affordable places in the area. What do you think that you have done to make things more affordable or to increase jobs, well-paying jobs?
Well, the increasing well-paying jobs, I think, both making Victoria Unleashing Potential, which was our first economic action plan, and now Victoria 3.0, which is our recovery, reinvention, and resilience plan. I think there are probably more well-paying tech jobs and other jobs. And again, this is anecdotal. We should probably do some analysis of it. But if you look at, a couple of things are indicators of well-paying jobs. And this one's a kind of an indirect indicator. When I took office, the downtown retail vacancy rate was over 10%. And pre-pandemic, we'd worked really hard with small businesses, with our business hub, to get that down to, it was just under 4%, I think 3.8% downtown retail vacancy. And obviously retail aren't necessarily those high paying jobs, although some can be. But what that shows is that there are people working in the downtown who are, patronizing the bars and restaurants and so on. There's been an absolute increase in construction without question over the past 3 to 4 years and even longer. And construction jobs are well-paying jobs. So I think that one we've done well on, and we're working on a really exciting project now with the South Island Prosperity Partnership called COAST, which is the Center for Ocean Applied Sustainable Technologies. There's massive potential in the ocean and marine industry in terms of innovating and decarbonizing that entire industry. So that will produce more well-paying jobs. UVic has a new president who I think is a bit of a serial entrepreneur. So we're working on some interesting things with them. So yes, well-paying jobs, I think we can put a check mark beside. Making life and housing more affordable, I think we could probably give ourselves about a D. And that is really just, it's a number of things. One, it's only recently that we've been able to really tap into and unlock all of the money that's coming from the federal and provincial governments for housing. That began in 2016 with a regional housing first program. But, buildings of 200 people or 150 people, essentially from idea to move in, take about 5 years. So that's the kind of thing you were saying, we'd see the impacts in the future. I think the housing investments that are being made are one of those. But also, I know that housing supply is not the only thing that increases affordability. That's why we're working on lots of below market rental projects with nonprofits and BC Housing and the Capital Regional Housing Corporation. So that's a piece of it. But also, there is just simply not enough rental housing for all the people who live here and who want to live here. And so I think this is where I feel a bit frustrated in my role and sometimes with council and also with provincial legislation. Like, it should not take 2.5 years to approve a 42 unit rental building. It should take you know, 4 months at the most. And that mm-hmm. will have an impact. So some of those things we don't have control over, some of those things it's politics, you know, people don't want to vote for this project or that project for whatever reason. But I'm also optimistic that this fall in the provincial legislature, the province will make some big moves. We've really been pushing them to basically take away some of the constraints from local governments and some of the hoops that everyone has to jump through to just get housing built more quickly. And that will start to help. Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask about that because there's some critics who say that your strategy is kind of mainly to attract and accommodate developers to build more units, which, of course, we need more units. It is a growing city. But there's also been a lot of calls to add protection to existing housing and to those who are facing eviction or rent eviction, intimidation from landlords, poor maintenance. There's prices are just continue to rise at, you know, incredible rates. Do you feel like you could focus more on this side of the situation?
All of the things that you've listed for the most part are squarely within provincial jurisdiction and not municipal jurisdiction, with the exception of the standards of maintenance bylaw, which we did pass. So the city, that is provincial legislation, but we looked at the places where the province didn't have kind of fully robust enough legislation. And we did create a standards of maintenance bylaw to deal with those maintenance and repair issues. We've also created a tenant ambassador position. So we have somebody in City Hall whose full-time job it is to work with tenants. That did not exist before. And we also, coming out of some of the rent evictions that happened, the big ones in 2017, lobbied the province really hard to create more protections for renters. And the province passed legislation in April that was implemented in July to protect renters from rent evictions. It essentially, the provincial legislation essentially flipped things on its head. It used to be that the tenant had to apply to the residential tenancy branch to say, hey, I'm being rent evicted. Now the landlords have to go before they even begin their renovations and say, hey, this is what I'm planning. You know, am I able to remove tenants for this reason or that reason in order to do the renovations? And there, if you look at the legislation, there are only two or three things where rent eviction would be necessary like massive life safety upgrades to buildings and so on. But, you know, there's about a list of 20 things that are cosmetic and the residential tenancy branch would likely not grant a landlord the ability to evict tenants. So I actually feel like that is relatively well in hand through the provincial legislation. Since July 1st, there have been no cases before the residential tenancy branch assessment group or whatever it's called. There have been no landlords that have come forward and said, I need to evict my tenants to renovate. So I'm, you know, we'll monitor that legislation very, very carefully. And if it's working, there may be no need for the city to take any further action. I think that's where I'll leave that. I'm a very practical person. I know there's a lot of emotion around, fear of being evicted. And I was rent evicted. I mean, I was a counselor and I was living in a place that was a little house the guy was sold it and turned it into condos. And so I had to go find somewhere new to live. So I fundamentally get that fear, that instability. And I think we need to look at what's been put in place by the province that we lobbied so hard for. And let's see if there are any holes in that. If there are, we can patch them. But in the meantime, I do think we need to keep working on the supply side, because that's also an issue. And that is something we have a bit of control over. We can offer incentives to builders who want to build rental housing instead of condos. We can pay their legal fees like they do in New Westminster. We can offer more density in exchange for rental housing. Like there are other cities like New Westminster that have done a lot of work on an incentive program to get more rental built. So for me, it's not an either or, but I don't want to duplicate tools that have just recently been put in place until we see how they work a little bit better. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that there is anything more that you could do or any more relationship building with the province that could result in more protections?
Yesterday at council, we directed our staff to kind of down tools on the business rental license bylaw, which essentially was going to plug two potential holes in provincial legislation. Although if no one's evicted, then we don't need to worry about people being move back into to rental buildings at the same rates that they were in. So, but we did pass an advocacy motion to the province, which is, so that's another piece that the city's put in place. And we actually saw this come through really well last night in a public hearing. We've put in place a tenant assistance plan. So if somebody is rezoning their building, they have to take care of their tenants. They have to pay moving expenses. They have to help them find a new place at the same rate. They have to pay them 4 or 5 or 6 months of rent based on how long they've been there. And again, that's a new policy that we've put in place to protect tenants. So I think some of those things have and will continue to make a difference. But as part of the motion yesterday, we did and will continue to advocate to the province to allow us to implement our tenant assistance policy at the time of a building permit or development permit. So right now, because of provincial legislation, we're only allowed to enact that and request that of the development community when they're, excuse me, rezoning a building. Mm-hmm. But what we'd like the province to do is make changes so our tenant assistance policy can apply at a building permit or development permit stage as well. And again, that's an additional layer of protections for tenants.
Okay. Also to do with housing, you have a missing middle housing strategy, which is now in its second phase of engagement. It's a pretty big strategy, and you have 1 year left. How do you think that you're going to balance going through all the proper consultation, getting it all through before it becomes an election issue, and then, you know, the future of it is up in the air?
Yeah, just by doing exactly that. I'd like to see this before council by the end of the first quarter of next year at the very latest. I think our staff are working to that timeline. It is a big proposed change. It will set the table for the future in the same way that when single family zoning was put in place in the 1930s in cities across North America, it excluded a whole bunch of people from living in a whole bunch of neighborhoods that are very desirable across North America, including in Victoria. And so this is a big change. We're doing the second phase of consultation right now. As you said, staff will come back hopefully early in the new year, and then we'll make those changes that are necessary to again set the table for the future and make sure that all our neighborhoods are much more inclusive than they have been since the 1930s when this exclusionary single family zoning was put in place.
Where do you think the balance is between making sure this gets done before it becomes an issue, or letting it be done properly and perhaps, you know, seeing it go through the election cycle?
I think it would go completely off the rails if it has to go through the election cycle. And what is more, we're in a housing crisis. We can't drag out policy changes for 12 months. That doesn't make any sense. There are families who are leaving Victoria because they can't find any place to buy because single family homes cost over $1 million. Mm-hmm. That is not good. In my mind, we should just, you know, we've had the first round of consultation. We'll do a little bit of consultation and then let's see what's, the first round was very positive. It's like, yes, please go in this direction. We want to stay in the city. So I think this is where I think political courage and pushing is really important. When you're in a crisis, you don't take 12 months to make a policy change.
The other thing that I wanted to ask you about policy and the things that have been going on is 24/7 camping. Do you think that you got it right
to allow 24/7 camping during the pandemic?
And then to go back, I mean, it is a lot to do with the province as well. I understand that. But then to go back on it after we've, you know, got through the first three waves of the pandemic. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. I think it was the right decision to make to allow people to shelter in place before vaccinations were widely available and public health advances had been made. And we worked really hard with the province to move over 600 people inside into temporary shelter, which, you know, a motel room is not a home, a cot is not a home, but each of those people who moved inside are on a pathway to permanent housing. Unless there's extenuating circumstances, they wouldn't be evicted back onto the streets. And I think 90% of the people who've moved in are doing really well. So that was, I think, the right move. We are following the Supreme Court decision, which allows people to shelter overnight and to seek shelter in that way. Cities aren't places for camping. I have been through enough tent cities to know that they're not good for anyone in the long run, including the vulnerable residents who end up living in them. This is Canada and it's the 21st century, and we're not a developing country. And we can't accept that 24/7 camping is any kind of solution. And so, for example, when the Capital Daily and others uncovered that there was apparently nowhere for people with COVID positive and living outdoors to go, we, again, this is one of those emergency meetings on a Sunday afternoon. All right, folks, let's get together. What are we going to do about this? And isolation spaces have been opened for people who are COVID positive and living outdoors. So if there are not as many people who are COVID positive and living outdoors, then those spaces are created and they'll be other people maybe who can be triaged into them to get them off the streets. But no, 24/7 camping is not the answer. There's no city in Canada that has 24/7 camping as an acceptable standard, and I don't know why we would be any different than that.
Do you think that you made Victoria a better place to live?
That is what people tell me. Over and over again, people stop me on the street, in the grocery store, send an email and say, you know what, my life is better and Victoria has become a better place to live. And, you know, obviously, I don't think that I did it, but I think over the past 7 years, council and staff and the community working together have made Victoria a better place to live. That's the general feedback that I get.
Okay. And what do you think that your legacy is going to be?
I really dislike that question because okay. I think the reason I dislike the question, which is my answer to the question, is because legacy places way too much focus on individualism and a mayor or a leader and legacy. It's kind of almost like like patriarchal or something. I don't mean it exactly like that. So. What I hope I've achieved is a city that is ready for the future. What I hope we've achieved is a city that's ready for the future. And again, as you said earlier in the interview, we won't know that until the future. We won't know that until 20 years from now, when hopefully we've met our emissions targets, when hopefully we have a circular economy, we're not throwing things in the garbage, when hopefully almost all of the cars in the city are electric powered, when hopefully kids are biking to and from the school and the community center and, you know, without parents on a safe bike network. So I think I don't like the legacy question because I think it focuses too much on kind of an individual and a legacy. I think what I hope we've done and will continue to do this next year is really set the table for the future.
Lisa, thank you again. This has been wonderful.
Yeah, thanks for your great questions. Enjoy the rest of your time in Toronto, and I guess we'll see you at some point.
Yeah, hopefully we could talk a couple more times.
Sounds good. I'll look forward to it. Bye, Jackie.
Right, bye. If you want to help support Capital Daily's local journalism and connect your business with our engaged and curious Greater Victoria audience of over 50,000, you can email our partnerships team at advertising@capitaldaily.ca. Thanks so much for spending some of your time with us. If you enjoyed the show, please leave a rating and a review, and also subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes going forward. We post new shows every Monday to Friday. My name is Jackie Lamport. This is the Capital Daily Podcast. We'll talk to you tomorrow.